Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm John Harvey Kraft, and I represent Ronald King in this matter. This is a very interesting case. It's a fascinating transcript to read. It's a large one to read. It'll give you many hours of reading pleasure. And I'm not saying this sarcastically. The government attorneys did an excellent job in fashioning a case here. They didn't have a whole lot to work with in the way of direct, solid evidence. They had wiretaps from five subjects, which led to wiretaps to the defendant's phones. They had bank records. They had pictures taken from poll cameras. Yet, despite many months of investigation, they were able to make an arrest or a seizure of drugs from Mr. King. Yet, they were able to put together a remarkable case. The only problem with their remarkable case is that it ran square into the teeth of the Crawford decision, in that it's relied to a great extent upon testimonial statements from out-of-court declarants, a number of people who were caught on audio tapes and who were in the government's control but were not brought into court as witnesses. Specifically, Kenyard Gilliard's conversations with Cedric Henderson were used, but Mr. Gilliard was not called as a witness, and they were relied upon the government to support its theory that Mr. King was managing an extensive empire. And it was used to inflate the scope of the conspiracy far beyond what the first-hand witnesses had to say about it. And similarly, statements of Anthony Harris and Roderick Porter were used not only to demonstrate their own involvement in the conspiracy, but to suggest a much broader and wider conspiracy. So those statements were used in a testimonial fashion. There is the question that's involved here in Crawford is not so much what the impact of the content of the testimony was, but the denial of the opportunity to confront these particular witnesses. And these witnesses' statements were used as witnesses' statements.
But the law is clear that co-conspirators' statements, though, can come in and that doesn't violate Crawford. Isn't that right?
I don't think so, sir. Okay. I think that other circuits have begun to touch on that. But you have to remember, Crawford cleared the table. Crawford said that the old rules about hearsay are gone, that they were no longer going to rely upon what professors and hornbooks had to say about evidence or what the latest fashion was amongst evidence scholars, but to look more to the heart of the matter, which is the statement used in a testimonial fashion. So is Borjali at risk as a result of Crawford? I think that it is. I think it's clear that what we have now is a situation where we have to look at what the import, what the nature of the use of the testimony was. And in this case, it was used as testimony. It wasn't used to support something else or to verify or corroborate. It was used to make positive assertions about the nature of the conspiracy. And Crawford stresses that we're not talking about what the evidence really does, but the fact that it is testimonial in nature and that it dispenses with confrontation.
What about our cases, Holmes and Robinson?
Yes.
I mean, don't we say that co-conspirator statements come in and Crawford doesn't impede that in any way?
Well, in light of Crawford and the nature to which they were used extensively there, I think all that has to be revisited, because the fact that a blanket exception is no longer permitted under Crawford, and to simply say something's allowed because it is a hearsay statement of a co-conspirator just doesn't simply fit under Crawford's overwhelming concern for the right of confrontation.
When was Crawford decided?
Crawford was decided sometime in 2004.
Now, we've got two post-Crawford cases, Holmes and Robinson.
I didn't approach those directly, sir. I'm sorry. I'll look down and see if there's more I need to do along that particular line. But what I would suggest is the gravamen of Crawford is what Crawford itself says, which says dispensing with confrontation because testimony is obviously reliable is akin to dispensing with jury trial because the defendant is obviously guilty. That's not what the Sixth Amendment prescribes. That's what we're talking about here. The old test of reliability, and a hearsay statement of a co-conspirator is considered reliable because it's said to further conspiracy. The conspirators are talking about it because they want to make their business move along, so they're not going to have reason to lie about it. Crawford says we're not concerned anymore with these tests for reliability. We're concerned with the deprivation of the right to confront. Remembering that a relatively minor witness, a witness who makes but a minor point, can, however, be of a great deal of importance in terms of confrontation because of why that testimony was developed, how that testimony fit into the case preparation, how the witness was approached. And so everything that surrounds the production of that testimony is as important as the testimony itself. And Crawford is meant to provide the opportunity, to preserve the opportunity for the defense to examine those particular areas. Also in this case, we talked about the out-of-court statements of Mrs. King. And those were admitted over defense objection, as were the others. Motions in limine were presented and objections were preserved at trial. Because she was asked, because testimony was presented from her lips through the recordings with regard, for instance, to the use of a truck in a rap video. And in the conversation, she wants to allow someone to use the truck in a rap video, and her husband doesn't. Well, the government uses this evidence as showing that he's trying to conceal his ill-gotten gains. They use her statements with regard to that, as she's asserting otherwise, as direct testimony against him, when in truth and in fact, the testimony itself does nothing to eliminate the possibility that the conversation could have been innocuous. It could have been directed toward concern about tax considerations. It could be directed in a number of different ways other than involvement in the drug statement. There simply was no reasonable exception to the interspousal communication privilege to allow that statement.
There is a co-conspirator exception to the spousal immunity.
Right, but there's a foundation that has to be laid. For instance, in Harrelson, the wife was the hearsay testimonies of the out-of-court statements of the wife in a private conversation that was intercepted. They were about paying off a hitman. And there are other cases where it's about directly furthering a drug conspiracy. But it's clear in those cases that the only thing they could be talking about is relative to advancing the conspiracy. If Bonnie and Clyde have a telephone conversation about the next bank they're going to rob, certainly that would be admissible over the interspousal privilege. If, however, Clyde calls up Sarah and says, I'm going to be late home tonight and I'm going to run in and I may need to put the car in the garage, leave the garage door open, and she doesn't know what it's about, her responses to that would not be admissible because she's not necessarily knowing and part of that conspiracy. In this case, we have conversations about not wanting a truck to be used in a rap video. We don't know how that fits into the conspiracy other than in the context of the government's theory, and that's what the interspousal communication privilege is supposed to prevent. There's also a question with regard to the court's approach to the sentencing guidelines in this matter. The court made a statement, is a perfectly garden variety statement that was made lots of times and people sentencing people prior to recent cases with regard to the nature of the guidelines. The statement that I have taken into account not only the guidelines but the sentencing factors in section 3553A and find there's no need to deviate from the calculations containing United States sentencing guidelines clearly indicates that the court was presuming the reasonableness of the sentencing guidelines. The recent cases, Gall and the others, suggest that there is no presumption of reasonableness for the guidelines, and although the guidelines are a factor that should be taken into consideration, they're to be given no further weight than anything else. The court certainly erred in allowing a presumption of reasonableness with regard to those guidelines. And if there are no further questions, I'll save some time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Kister?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I would like to cover the issues in the same order in which Mr. Kraft covered them, beginning with the 801D2E statements. Under the definitions in Crawford, the recorded statements by these co-conspirators who did not know that they were being taped, that they were on, there were wiretaps, neither of the parties knew that they were on a wiretap. One party testified at trial. The other party did not testify at trial. But the party testifying at trial did state what the one who did not testify had said. He could have done that without the taped statements, but we had the taped statements to support his view of what was said. Those have been universally held by all the courts of appeal that have addressed the issue. That 801D2E, co-conspirator statements, are not governed by Crawford because they do not meet the Supreme Court's definition of a testimonial statement in any of the factors that the court gave. The court gave specific examples stating that they were non-exclusive. The court also gave some general parameters to consider when determining whether or not a statement is testimonial for purposes of Crawford and the Sixth Amendment. And these statements do not fall within that category, and there are numerous circuit court cases, and in particular, I think in our district, Delgado is another case. You mentioned two, but Delgado is another case in which 801 D2E statements were supported, and the court considered Crawford and said Crawford does not apply to these statements. So I think the law is clear in this circuit and every other circuit that if it came in under 801 D2E and that was how these statements were admitted, then they are admissible and they were properly before the jury. With respect to the second issue, with regard to the marital privilege, Ron King had, there were two wiretaps in place. There were two different phones that had wiretaps in place. And there were hours and hours and hours of conversations. And the agents who were monitoring these conversations did make an effort to minimize many of them. It became apparent to them that the conversation between Veronica King and her husband, the defendant in this case, regarding whether or not to include her Cadillac or her truck in a rap video was really a discussion concerning whether or not those assets should remain concealed. And it was a discussion between Ron King and his wife in which she wanted to put these vehicles that were in her name in this rap video. He vehemently opposed it because someone might find out they were his, because after all, it was his money, and he made some statements, you know, you are me, I am you, what you have is from me, and a number of statements of that ilk were made in this conversation. And the government used that because the government charged money laundering in this case also, and this was an indication that Ron King was indeed hiding assets in other people's names. He had bank accounts. He also was hiding cars in his wife's name, and this pointed that up to the jury. The district judge had formal motion in limine from the defendant seeking to suppress the statements, and the government filed its in globo response to them, and those are in the record. And the judge dealt with these and addressed these right immediately before trial. And he made the ruling agreeing with the government that there was sufficient evidence that this was in connection with money laundering and that this was hiding and concealing assets and it was criminal conduct. So under the joint participation exception to the marital privilege for private communications, the court found that the government could admit these. And the government contends that this was a correct decision, and many, many, many cases deal with joint participation in criminal activity, and it was clear that Veronica King did participate with her husband in money laundering. The final issue is related to sentencing, and I believe the Supreme Court's recent cases of Gall, Rita, and, well, not really Kimbrough, Gall and Rita, certainly, indicate that the sentencing guidelines are indeed something that the courts have to continue to deal with, and they must properly calculate a guideline sentence. They are not obligated to sentence within that, but because of the history of the guidelines and the way they are maintained, they do equal a reasonable sentence for the most part. For most defendants guilty of a particular crime who fit the categories of the guidelines, they are can be considered a reasonable sentence. The district judge in this case stated that he recognized under 3553A he could deviate from the guidelines, but he found no reason to do so. He did sentence defendant to, I believe it was towards the lower end of the guidelines on his for the offenses. and he ran the sentences concurrently. So defendant has not been penalized the most severe level that he could have been. And the judge stated expressly that he felt it was a reasonable sentence, and the government does believe that he was sentenced to a reasonable sentence given the scope of the entire conspiracy and his involvement in it. He was truly the leader of the conspiracy and had many tentacles out there transporting cocaine, not personally himself. He managed to keep himself from ever having to, I think, directly touch anything, but he was clearly the leader of the conspiracy. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kraft, back to you.
Submitted, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We have your case. We call the next case, Dr. Lamb.